This is the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James. Well, recently we traveled to Washington, D.C. and to Capitol Hill to meet with members of the House and caught up with the chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, Bruce Westerman from Arkansas. He'll join us in just a moment. First off, Brad Rippey, USDA meteorologist, latest on corn crop development.
As for the stages of development for the corn, as of August 13th, we see almost two-thirds of the corn, 65% nationally, reaching the dough stage. That's 2 points ahead of the five-year average. Now, as we move to the corn dented stage, 18% is your national number for August 13th, exactly on par with the five-year average, and ahead of last year's 15%.
It's the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James. We're joined today by the Honorable Bruce Westerman, who represents the 4th Congressional District of Arkansas. It's great to see you.
Great to be with you, Tony. And, you know, when you talk about agriculture and rural America, you're talking about the 4th District of Arkansas. There's 75 counties in Arkansas. Four members of Congress, but 33 counties are in my district. So that tells you there's a lot of land, a lot of trees, a lot of farmland, not a whole lot of people.
So how are things back home in the district right now? Dry, wet, perfect?
We had a good rainfall in the spring. It's starting to dry out now, but actually had some storms back home this morning. And compared to the end of last summer, from a drought standpoint, we're in good shape, but that could all change. You know, I think we went from August to October without much rainfall at all last year, and it got really tough. You know, creek beds with no water in them, cow pastures that look like dust bowls, people having to feed hay early. You know, all those, from my FFA days, those joys and discomforts of agricultural life that we've come to appreciate. We were seeing that those discomforts firsthand last summer. Hopefully it won't be that bad this summer.
You're really describing natural resources. It's really what you're describing.
Oh, yeah.
And you're on that committee. That's kind of apropos, I guess.
Yeah, actually the chairman of that committee, it's one I've been on since I've been in Congress. And you know, I have a great appreciation for our rural way of life, a great appreciation for our resources. I say I'm a conservative in the truest sense of a conservative. The word conservation is derived from conservative. And I wish I could take credit for this, but a philosopher said a conservative is someone who believes in unchosen obligations. So as I look at the blessings we experience in this country today, and I look at the sacrifices, the form of government that was given to us, as I look back in history, I feel like I've got an unchosen obligation to conserve those principles of our founding. But also as I look forward to the future and I think about my kids, grandkids, and great-grandkids that haven't been born yet, I've got an unchosen obligation to make sure that they have the same opportunities, that we take care of our resources, that we're good stewards of them, and that you know, future generations have the same opportunities we had. So, you know, looking forward and looking back, I'm proud to be a conservative that believes in conservation. I've always said that rural people, sportsmen and women, are the ultra-conservationists. They understand that you take care of the land and the land takes care of us. So I let that guide a lot of my decisions as chairman of the committee. I'm the only licensed forester in Congress, and so there's a lot of ways that forestry benefits our country that people don't even realize. You know, about two-thirds of our drinking water in America comes off of forested lands. So we've got, an obligation to take care of these resources that we've got, use them, get the benefit out of them, and make sure that we're good stewards for the future.
Could we look at some of the areas that have experienced just horrific wildfire? I know there's a place in New Mexico where the fire burnt 6 years ago, and it burned so hot that the soil is gone, the trees are gone, nothing's there. And when it rains, you now have mudslides.
are those things that we can fix? Can Congress have a hand in that?
So, Tony, unfortunately, there are so many of those places. I don't know which specific one you're talking about, but I've been to the Lincoln National Forest and observed something very, very amazing there. Same landscape, same climate, same forest and tree species. You've got the Muscalero Apache tribe that is textbook forest management. Beautiful forest out there. Ponderosa pine. It's got your savanna understory in it. Great elk hunting. Just beautiful habitat. You go up the road a few miles and you're in the Lincoln National Forest, which it had one of those fires. And I don't remember how many years ago, but it's like a moonscape. The fire burned so hot that it burned the organic matter out of the soil, and they can't get trees to grow back on it. Everything the same, except you had the Forest Service managing one tract of land, and you had the Muscalero Apache managing another tract. And that's why we just passed out a committee this morning a bill to do good neighbor authority, which says tribes and counties, in addition to state forest management agencies, can go in and manage timber on federal lands. They know how to do it. They're able to do it. So let's give them the authority to go in and make these good management decisions. But you can, that story I told about New Mexico, it's been replicated other times in New Mexico. You can go to California, Arizona, go to Washington State. You'll see over and over where you've got severe damage to the soil because of mismanagement of forest. And people don't always make that link between water and forestry. Now, Teddy Roosevelt called trees the lungs of the earth. They breathe in carbon dioxide. They breathe out oxygen, which they are. There's nothing we can use to clean the air, to get carbon out of the atmosphere as efficient and as effectively and as large scale and economically as a forest. Forests also are as critical to water as they are to air. You talked about these as, I'll use Roosevelt's terms, a denuded landscape. You take this barren landscape, you get rain on it, you get mudslides, your topsoil, what's left of it, ends up in the streams, which decreases water quality, damages fish habitat. You know, when you do good forest management, if there's a stream, you leave something called the streamside management zone. A wildfire doesn't leave streamside management zones. It burns right to the edge of the stream. That shade over a stream helps keep water cool for certain fish species. You take that shade away, the water temperature increases. There's just so many wins to having healthy managed forest. You win with air quality, you win with water quality, you win with wildlife habitat, you win with recreation opportunities. And the list goes on. There's no downside to having a healthy forest. We just have to help our forest be healthy instead of getting in the way and making them unhealthy.
Appreciate you taking the time to come by. I know your schedule is so busy right now, but thanks for your time. Will you come back and see us?
We'd love to. We didn't even talk about biochar and how that can help with agriculture in the future. Biochar is almost pure carbon. We could take this understory in the western forest that's fueling the catastrophic wildfires, make a usable product out of it, put it on agriculture and range land and even back on forest land, and it makes your soil more productive, holds more water, retains more nutrients, makes them available for plant uptake, and also makes your forest healthy. So there's so many natural solutions to the problems we face today. We just have to have the will in Congress to push that policy forward, to let the innovators innovate, and let this great country thrive.
In other words, there'll be another episode of this, so come back and see us.
Anytime. Thank you, Tony.
Again, it's the Honorable Bruce Westerman, who represents the 4th Congressional District of Arkansas, and joins us on today's Agribusiness Report.
American agriculture creates millions of jobs, all the while feeding and clothing the world. But with many policymakers so removed from the farm, attacks on farm policy threaten our livelihood and quality of life in rural America. Our strength is our willingness to work together for the benefit of all. That's why business and farm leaders have formed the Southwest Council of Agribusiness, to defend the bedrock of our economy and our way of life. This is Larry Combest. The Southwest Council of Agribusiness is at southwest-council.com.
At Plains Cotton Cooperative Association, our mission is to ensure the long-term profitability of our grower owners through value-added marketing programs and through services to their gins. As a true cooperative, we pay dividends back to our grower owners to financially strengthen their farming operations, whether in Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, or New Mexico. Rest assured, at PCCA, we make money for you, not from you.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Agribusiness Report. Our special guest today, Bruce Westerman, representative from Arkansas, chairman of the Natural Resources Committee. Nick Paulson is with the University of Illinois, talks about fertilizer prices and year-over-year comparisons.
Fertilizer prices started to climb in 2021 as commodity and energy prices also climbed. Prices continued to rise, peaking in the second quarter of 2022 with the uncertainty introduced by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. In Illinois, anhydrous ammonia hit $1,635 per ton, and the prices for both urea and diammonium phosphate, or DAP, reached over $1,000 per ton. However, prices have fallen substantially since then. As of late July 2023, anhydrous ammonia is down to around $870 per ton, a 47% drop from last year's peak. Urea is now about $497 per ton, declining over 50%. DAP has fallen to $822 per ton, a 20% decrease. Other fertilizers like liquid nitrogen and potash have seen price drops between 20 to 35% as well. So what's driven this year-long decline in fertilizer prices? A few key factors. First, high prices last year reduced demand as farmers adjusted fertilizer applications. Second, fertilizer production capacity has expanded over the past year, increasing global supplies. This has helped meet demand at lower price levels. Third, markets have adjusted to the disruptions caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Sanctions on Russian exports led to a lot of uncertainty in early 2022, but trade flows adjusted, perhaps more smoothly than expected. The price of natural gas, a key input for nitrogen fertilizers, has also fallen over the past year, and average corn prices are down around 12% from their peak last June. So what does this mean looking ahead? While prices are down, they remain relatively high historically. The downward trend may not result in benefits for 2023 returns, as farmers likely paid higher prices for this year's needs. But current levels may provide opportunities for 2024. Natural gas futures suggest prices may rise over the next 6 months, and 2024 corn prices are expected to be around or under $5 per bushel. Given these market expectations, now could be a decent time to price 2024 fertilizer needs. Prices are approaching levels last seen in late 2021 before the run-up. Locking in a portion could make sense despite the downward trend. The risks of more supply chain disruptions due to the Russia-Ukraine conflict persist as well. So while the extended price slide may make it tempting to continue to wait for even lower prices, current economics and ongoing uncertainty suggest considering some pricing for 2024 fertilizers. That wraps up our review of the year-long decline in fertilizer prices. While prices remain high historically, the drop over the past year provides some pricing opportunities for 2024.
It's the Agribusiness Report.
Success is attained by those who approach problems with a plan and a purpose. As an advocate for High Plains cotton growers since 1956, Plains Cotton Growers has been tackling the tough issues facing cotton growers through beneficial legislative and regulatory changes. An important part of PCG's success is through close working relationships with congressional representatives and federal regulatory staff, allowing cotton growers more time to devote to farming operations. From the halls of Congress to the dusty turnroads of the High Plains, cotton producers depend on Plains Cotton Growers.
Let's talk about cotton research. Cotton Incorporated funds more than 400 ag research projects every year. They study cotton, engineering, economic development, entomology, agronomy, pathology, variety selection, expanded cotton seed uses, And that's just the start. You grow the cotton research and promotion program helps grow the value. Learn more at cottonboard.org.
It's the Agribusiness Report. You can hear more of our interviews from Washington, D.C. online, allagnews.com.
Texas Corn Producers serves the state's corn farmers through both the Corn Board and the Association. The board is putting your checkoff dollars to work in research, promotion, and education to ensure producer profitability and market expansion. The member-supported association is the farmer's advocate in Austin and Washington, D.C. on issues from the Farm Bill, water and property rights, and more. Join the Texas Corn Producers Association today and get the latest news and information about Texas Corn Producers' efforts online at www.texascorn.org.
Where is the beef industry heading? Find out firsthand October 8th, 9th, and 10th at the Gaylord Texan Resort in Grapevine. It's Texas Cattle Feeders Association's annual convention featuring John Foley, a former Blue Angels pilot, and mentalist and illusionist Wayne Hoffman. The 2023 TCFA Annual Convention in Grapevine. Learn more online, tcfa.org. It's the Agribusiness Report.
Much like soybeans, U.S. cotton production in August was the primary driver in USDA global production and balance sheet forecast.
A relatively large reduction in the U.S. crop based on the data we received from NAST, and that reduces U.S. supplies by 2.5 million bales.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski says, in addition, the world cotton supply and demand ledger is impacted by increased consumption by China.
So this increased global demand is happening at the same time that U.S. supplies are forecasted lower. Global ending stocks tightening up by just under 3 million bales.
Supplies were also tightened on the domestic balance sheet.
Half of the decline in the U.S. production forecast came out of exports.
The season-ending average price for cotton was raised 3 cents month over month to 79 cents per pound, down from 82 cents from the previous year. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.